The following program contains scenes and language of a frank and explicit nature. Viewer discretion is advised.
There are only two things I can't stand in this world. People who are intolerant of other people's cultures, and the Dutch.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Film Jitsu, the podcast that wields films like deadly weapons. We are your hosts. I am Mike.
And I am John.
This week on Film Jitsu, John and I will both be reviewing the summer blockbuster Sex and the City 2. Our listeners chose this film for us on one of our online polls, and we were lucky enough to waste our money to go and see it.
Happy anniversary.
Me and you, just us two.
And in 2 years, amazing things can happen.
Amazing. I never make it.
Really? They're driving me crazy.
I've tricked my body into thinking it's younger.
How are you going to swallow all those?
Have we met?
As for me, Big and I were somewhere between wild sex and a baby.
I don't know which is worse.
Samantha, the baby will tire eventually. Big and I are getting a little too Mr. and Mrs. Married. We have to work on the sparkle.
Sparkle.
And just when you think you've seen it all, you're wearing white.
Like a virgin.
What happens after you say I do? I think we need some glamour.
1 week in Abu Dhabi, all expenses paid for all four of us.
Get out of town.
My point exactly.
I can hear the decadence calling.
Ooh. I don't think we're in Kansas anymore.
I'm having a hot flash.
You're on a camel in the middle of the Arabian desert. If you're not having a hot flash, you're dead.
Champagne.
You are fun in Abu Dhabi.
This is the best mirage that I've ever had.
What?
I'm talking like, I don't know you. Come here, you.
Being a mother is hard.
I needed a break.
We bump into each other halfway around the world, and it means something.
I think you're playing with fire.
Something happened.
Deal ages ago. Man, babies, doesn't matter. We're soulmates.
Is Jasmine in Aladdin?
Yes, sweetie, but with cocktails.
So, John, how much money did you have to spend to go see Sex and the City 2 this past week?
I went to a smaller theater to see it, so it was only $8.
Oh, I spent $10.50.
Oh.
Well, I got hosed.
Seriously.
I don't know about you, buddy. I have a lot to say about this movie.
You know, I simultaneously have a lot to say about this movie and want nothing to say about this movie.
Well, we're doing a podcast. That's not really an option.
No.
This would be the worst podcast ever if that was it.
Yeah, we're done. We're done with this movie.
Just angry silence for 40 minutes?
So, under what circumstances did you see this movie? Let's set it up for the listeners. They chose this. We put up a poll and said, which movie should Mike and John go see in the theater and spend their hard-earned cash on? And this is what our listeners saw fit to shackle us with. So, did you go alone? Did you go with a friend? How did you go see this movie?
Well, I took my wife on a Saturday night. She and I went to see it after having dinner. My wife is not a fan of the show. She's never seen an episode, nor have I. So we both went into it blind. She didn't really know anything about it. I know the basic premise. I know who Carrie Bradshaw is. I know that she's a writer. And, you know, the basic setup, I know. My wife had no idea. So we went together as sort of a date movie, I guess. I thought maybe she'd like it. Maybe she won't. I'm probably going to definitely hate it. We'll see what happens. And so we go to the theater and we get in. The theater is full of nothing but women and a couple of guys who looked probably just as angry as I did. What about you? Did you take your imaginary friend?
No, I did not take Jess. I went on Wednesday with a friend of mine who is actually the same person I saw the original Sex and the City movie with. A friend of mine who I used to live with was really into the show, and one Sunday when we were just home doing some work or whatever, you know, snowy winter Sunday type of thing, getting some stuff done around the house, she popped the movie and wanted to see it. So it was sort of, for me, it was more background noise, but I did watch, you know, most of the movie, and it was meh, you know. I wasn't offended by it. I wasn't, you know, excited to watch it. So I went with her. I figured, you know, it's nice symmetry. Saw the first one with her. She is a big fan of the series, so I can get some reaction from her. The theater, it was probably about half full, and it was, my theater was also mostly women. There were a couple of guys there, two of them sitting together, so I made some assumptions. So, I don't know, the movie opens up, and I think it was probably about 2 minutes into it, at which my friend Erica and I turned to each other and both went, "What the fuck?" And that was pretty much where it went from there.
You know, I think I had something of an out-of-body experience while watching this movie, because I don't remember this, but my wife afterwards told me she was embarrassed because I spent the whole movie sighing and huffing and puffing, and she said at one point I loudly asked, "What the fuck is going on in this movie?" which I don't remember doing. So I think my body somehow sat in the theater watching this movie while my soul took a vacation somewhere else, which was probably for the better.
I think it probably was. In fact, speaking of your reaction to this movie, I'd like to cue up a little something for the listeners. Because it turns out that you called my phone. Now, I was out doing other things, but you called my phone and left a voicemail during the movie.
I did. I had to step out of the theater at about the 2 hour mark, I think. I don't know.
Yeah, it was about the 2 hour mark. So let's play that for the listener so they get a sense of where your head was at about the 2 hour mark in this movie.
How fucking long is this movie? I've been in here for 2 hours, and it seems to show no sign of stopping. I'm really on the brink of, like, a nervous breakdown. I think I started ovulating. What the fuck? This movie is like a terrorist training video. I hate you. I hate our listeners. I quit.
I listened to that and nearly died laughing. I actually played it for everybody I was hanging out with.
First of all, I believe that I had some harsh words for our listeners. Now that I've had the time to calm down, I would like to apologize. I love our listeners dearly. I don't wish any hate upon them, but this is the last time I'm going to let them decide which movie I get to go see.
We probably should have opened up this review with an apology for whatever we did.
I don't know what I did to make the listeners so angry.
I mean, I've said a few things that I can imagine them wanting to come at me with this with, but this seems like punishment for an unforgivable sin.
Well, Sex and the City 2 was like my vagina on an acid trip. And I don't even have a vagina.
You are the second person I've heard describe it as an acid trip.
I can't believe that the things that were going on the screen were what was actually put out there. First of all, I want it to be known that I tried really hard not to view this movie as a guy who just doesn't get it, or a guy that this movie wasn't directed for. You know, I did that with The First Wives Club. It was a movie that was not made for me. So I tried really hard to be objective and say, okay, this is a movie made for women. That's the audience. So I'm going to try and consume the movie with all of my dumb macho guy bullshit checked at the door. I'm going to really try. And what I got was so appalling to me that I was amazed that there are any women in the country that see this film and think that these are characters or a story that somehow speaks to them. This movie embodies everything that's appalling about our materialistic culture. It's about a group of women who are all beautiful. They seem to have no shortage of money. They don't ever seem to have to go to work. And they just live these charmed lives, and they run around consuming, buying clothes, eating food. You know, they just live these extravagant lifestyles. And I couldn't help but thinking, what woman in this theater can see these women and identify with the kind of bullshit life that they're leading? It was really amazing to me. I've always heard that Sex and the City is a show about strong female voices with strong characters, and their sex lives are their own, and, you know, they're these amazing modern independent women. And I saw it and I thought, my God, if this is what our idea of a strong female voice is, then we're in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, and it's funny you should say that, because all the women that I've talked to that really liked the show, hated this movie for the same exact reasons.
Oh, I feel so much better hearing that. My wife had no background on the show, so we came out of the movie, and the first thing I did was ask her, what did you think? And she said she hated it. She couldn't believe that these women were so terrible. And I felt really good knowing that my wife landed on that side of the issue. It made me feel like, okay, she really is incredible.
Yeah.
And to use her for an example, I think that my wife, I've said it before on the show, she's an incredible, smart, independent woman that changes the world every day because of what she does for a living. She's a teacher. And she has an incredibly strong female voice. You've met my wife. I don't think that's a matter of dispute.
No, not at all.
She was offended by the portrayal of what a strong female voice is supposed to be in Sex and the City 2.
Yeah. And I think the problem is that the show has always had a little bit of opulence about it. And early on, I've seen some episodes from early seasons, and those are the episodes that a lot of my friends who really liked the show fell in love with. And while they did have these, you know, sort of extravagant lives where they were ritzier people living in Manhattan, and it's not like they were, you know, the average Joe Schmo on the block, there was more of humanity behind their character, so you could overlook that. And one of the strong things about the show was that these women, even though they seemed to have everything, still had a lot of the normal struggles that women have. They had trouble being heard in the workplace or climbing the corporate ladder or finding the right person. And so it was the same kind of struggles that everyday women have. And so in a lot of women identified with that from the aspect of, these are women who have everything I think I want, but they still have the same problem. So it was almost a grounding thing for a lot of people.
Sure.
And I think what they really did is, and I've heard they've done this as the show went on as well, and especially in this movie, is they took that materialistic nature of the show that was on the side there, and they amped that up, and they dialed back all of the actual character and human qualities of these women. And so instead of just being a character-driven show that happened to have these things on the side, it became, you know, punny one-liners and over-the-top extravagance.
These women all seemed like parodies of an archetype for me, which is an amazing phrase in and of itself. I mean, to parody an archetype is really something special, but I didn't know anything about this show and the characters really, but it was quick for me to see that there was the conservative one, there was the cougar that was all about sex, 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 there was the other one that she was very career-minded, and then there was Carrie Bradshaw, who was the main character, and she was the sex writer, and she narrates the whole thing, and I believe there's a running narration through the show.
Yes.
With her. So I kind of got what they were all about, but they just seemed like caricatures of those roles.
Yeah.
And I got the impression, especially with the Kim Cattrall character, that a lot of these jokes have worn out their welcome. I got the sense that for the entire run of this show, that character has been all about sex jokes and her chasing after younger men and having sex and all this sexual freedom and all that kind of stuff, which I can see where people would identify with that character. You know, I think that is supposed to be a very progressive female character that we haven't seen before on television, but it seemed like that joke in this movie has really played out its last legs. There was a wedding scene at the beginning of this movie that seemed to be 40 minutes long.
Easily 40 minutes.
I believe that you referred to it before we started recording as Bilbo's birthday party.
Yes.
It was like a 40-minute long wedding scene, and there is a lot to be said about this wedding scene. I don't know if you want to talk about it. I don't know if this is the area of the film I'm particularly interested in getting crazy about.
No, it definitely isn't the part I'm crazy about. I mean, the thing that struck me about the wedding was it's not really a wedding so much as a hate crime. This was supposed to be their nod to their gay audience, and it was more a slap in the face to their gay audience, because it wasn't, let's do, you know, a gay wedding because the show's all about weddings and we want to incorporate that side of weddings to show our support and solidarity for our gay audience. It was, how many stereotypes can we cram into one scene? And it's like, well, actually a lot, since the scene's a good 40, 45 minutes, you can cram a lot of stereotypes into that scene. And I remember looking over at a friend of mine that I was with and saying, are we still at this wedding? What's going on?
I was really hoping that this whole wedding shenanigans was just happening because I didn't understand enough about the two characters getting married to understand what was happening. And maybe that's the case. Maybe it is. But it seemed as though they threw every ridiculous gay stereotype they could into this one scene. They talked about how one of them, they were getting married, but one of the guys was going to be allowed to cheat.
Yep.
And they talked about Liza Minnelli. Liza Minnelli comes and officiates the wedding, and she performs afterwards. And there's an all-male chorus wearing top hats and singing show tunes. They had a little moat with swans in them. It was ridiculous. I mean, it was like a big musical.
Yeah. Carrie puts on that awful Cher headdress thing.
I don't know what that was. It was weird. She looked like Meg Foster in Masters of the Universe.
Oh, man.
I know that this show has a pretty big following in the gay community. It's a popular show. I couldn't see this and think, oh, well, they must love this portrayal. I don't know. It just seemed to me like I would probably be offended if I were a part of the group that had all of these stereotypes being thrown at me. Maybe it was endearing. I mean, like I said, I don't understand the history of the show.
Yeah.
To me, it seemed sort of like a hate crime.
Yeah.
I don't want to be extreme. That's a hard word to use, and I don't want to, you know, take away from what that actually means. So maybe that's not the right word. But it did seem like there was a degree of insensitivity going on during this 40-minute wedding.
It fit into that caricature that the entire movie became of the original show.
Right.
It really did. It was just over the top and ridiculous for the sake of ridiculous. I mean, the thing is that scene does have, if I were to give this movie, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly of this movie, you know, the bad being the entire script and the ugly being Sarah Jessica Parker, the good was the CG on that Liza Minnelli dance number.
Yeah, there was no way that was Liza.
That is not Liza. There is no way in hell that's Liza. That was some damn good CG, though.
Yeah, they stuck her face on somebody else's body and it worked.
Yeah.
You know, the part of the movie that really troubled me, the part that really got me worked up, is that after an hour into this movie, they managed by some bizarre pretense to take the Sex and the City girls and put them on a private plane owned by some Middle Eastern sheik and fly them off to Abu Dhabi, where they're going to stay in a $22,000 a night hotel. And now we have taken all of this horrible materialistic bullshit and dropped it into the Middle East, where we have now presented ourselves with a seemingly endless stream of culturally insensitive, stereotypical moments that I couldn't believe anybody allowed on screen. It was just tasteless.
Yeah, there's a reason they had to film in Morocco. No one in the Middle East wanted any part of this.
They spent the whole time in the Middle East, and it was sort of a fish out of water. You know, these Manhattanites, and now they're trying to ride camels around the desert. They make jokes about flying carpets, and they go to the spice market. They take these women, and they drop them in the middle of all of this Middle Eastern stereotyping, and then justify it with some half-cocked tip of the hat to the oppressed women of the Middle East, as though that were to justify all of the offensive shit that they had laid out in the ensuing hour.
It's just lazy writing. I can't imagine that if you look at the script as a writer when you're done with it, you look at that and somehow you feel that that's okay. Like you were doing a service of presenting these communities in a way that was helpful and bridging the gap between them and us, because they were being all of the negative stereotypes about the US and Americans elsewhere and plopped into the middle of all of these stereotypes about other communities, like the gay community at the wedding and the Middle Eastern communities when they get to Abu Dhabi. It was just ridiculousness.
I have to say, John, like, I was embarrassed as a film goer that there weren't a whole bunch of people walking out on this movie. I have to tell you, were it not for the fact that I was watching this for the show, I would have walked out on this movie. And not because it was a Sex and the City movie and I'm a guy or any of that stuff. I would have walked out on this movie because the content being presented was so absurdly tasteless that I couldn't have sat through and seen it as a form of entertainment. And I don't mean to sound high and mighty and self-righteous and any of that kind of stuff, but it really was that extreme. It made the racist robots from Transformers 2 look like a corporate sensitivity training video. It was that out of hand.
I mean, I felt the same way, though. I feel like they really shat on every group that they presented in this movie. And ultimately, I think they shat on their fans as well. Because basically what they said with this movie was, our fans are mindless, materialistic consumers, and they're going to lap up whatever we vomit onto the screen because our cast is fabulous. And it's like, no.
Well, the good news is that it seems that the reaction has been universally upset at the final product. I have read a couple of reviews. I made it a point to only read reviews by female film critics. I thought that was probably the way to go. And so every single one of them that I have read have said basically the same thing that I was feeling walking out of the theater. And so I felt justified in my criticism of this film in that the female audience and the longtime fans of this show really seem to feel like not only was this the worst product they've been given so far, but it was also so outrageous in the way that it played out that none of them enjoyed any part of the movie, from the ridiculous stereotypes to the cultural insensitivity to the terrible writing, which was basically just sitcom style setup, punchline, setup, punchline, dumb pun.
Yeah.
The biggest laugh in the whole theater while I was there was pulled straight out of a Kevin Smith film. There's a scene in the desert where Samantha sees this handsome guy riding around in his Jeep, and she's talking about how, you know, she's gonna bed him, which I assume is kind of what she's talking about all the time, and she refers to him as Lawrence of My Labia. And the theater lost it. It was like the funniest joke this crowd of women had ever heard. And I was looking around feeling like I was taking crazy pills, because that was a line word for word pulled out of Zach and Miri Make a Porno when they were trying to name their porno. They were coming up with all kinds of different lines, and Lawrence of Arabia was one of the jokes. That got the biggest laugh in the entire film, a joke that Kevin Smith made 2 years ago.
Yeah, it was interesting to me to watch because even down to the camera angles, it felt sitcom. I mean, when they were delivering those witty punchlines and the repartee back and forth, which is such bullshit because it was awful writing. I'm just using those words anyway. Camera cutting between characters felt like a sitcom.
Which, the original Sex and the City television show was not a sitcom.
No, and it didn't have any of that silliness to it. At least the episodes I saw.
Do we want to talk a quick second about the fashion? I know that fashion is a big deal in Sex and the City. That's always been the big thing. These girls are fashion icons, and anything Carrie Bradshaw wore on screen popped up all over New York as the next big thing. I think we have heard a thank for Uggs, those ridiculous Eskimo boots that people wear around all the time, which I want you to know they will be embarrassed about when they look back at photos of themselves 20 years from now. So, I don't know if it's always been this way, but some of the outfits they were wearing, there was a scene on an airplane where Sarah Jessica Parker was wearing what looked like a giant pinata on her head. And they were all out at a club one night, and Samantha was wearing a dress that had shoulder spikes. Like Legion of Doom from the WWF when I was a kid, shoulder spikes.
Yeah, something straight out of a Raiders game.
It was. It looked like the Black Hole. It was ridiculous. The costume seemed to me to be pulled straight out of the Fifth Element.
Yeah, it really was. And the sad thing is they spent $10 million on costumes alone.
On the clothes for this film?
On the clothes for this film, $10 million they spent on that, and they were awful. I, like you did with the Only Reading Women reviews of the movie to try to get some of that sense, to make sure you were separating your, I'm a guy, this isn't made for me. I made it a point to call all of my friends that I know liked the show, as well as read some of the women reviews, and every one of them had the same comment about how awful all of the clothes were.
Oh, good, because it seemed like sci-fi. It really did. I couldn't tell the difference between the girls and Sex and the City and Padme from Phantom Menace.
In fact, we're going to link to, in the bonus features of the site, we're going to link to an article that details for you how Sex and the City is a sci-fi movie. It's pretty well done.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I read it the other day. A friend of mine sent it to me, and I waited till after the movie, but I read it, and it's pretty funny.
So, I guess, John, let's start wrapping up our conversation here of Sex and the City 2. What is the take-home message for this film?
That everyone involved with it should be ashamed of themselves.
I really think that's it. I really do. I was horrified at what was presented to me because All I knew was the reputation of this show, of being this big, groundbreaking, girl power, progressive, game-changing television show. That was what I knew about it, and I thought, wow, this is going to be something really cool. Not for me kind of cool, but something really different. And I went and I saw it, and what was put up on the screen was a catastrophe from every angle. From the horrid phoned-in acting, really sitcom-level acting, to go along with the sitcom-level writing, to the laundry list of culturally offensive moments. And really, again, I'm not just being self-righteous here. This stuff here, I'm a pretty open guy when it comes to pushing the line. And, you know, I'm not above being a little bit crass from time to time. But this movie went in a direction that I really think the filmmakers should be ashamed of. And I'm surprised that these actresses agreed to be a part of, because I don't know how you would see this final product and want to put your name on it. I think maybe it seems to me like it could be the end of Sex and the City, once and for all.
I hope so. If this is what they're going to continue to do, I really hope so.
Me too, because it's a terrorist training video, is what it is.
Absolutely.
Is what it is. I, you know, if I were sitting in a terrorist training camp, all they would have to do was put on Sex and the City 2 and be like, that's why. That would be enough for me.
Yep.
I'd be like, okay, well, game on.
I've got bigger. I'll put it right at you. I'll see you, baby. You're a hoochie coo.
Well, I think that's probably a good point to segue into our bottom five and get back to the fun of the show.
Yeah, I'd like to go ahead and send a curse onto all of our listeners for making us watch Sex and the City 2. You did a terrible thing to us. I don't know what we did to deserve it. Curse you. I guess, well, we make them listen to this dumb show week in and week out.
Yeah, but they've lost their movie-picking privileges for a little while.
Yeah, you're all on hiatus.
Well, to go along with this, in an inspired choice, you came up with Bottom 5 Actress Faces.
Yes.
As we all know how you feel about Sarah Jessica Horseface.
That's right.
So, fittingly, why don't you start us off with your number 5, Bottom 5 Actress Face?
Well, for me, Bottom 5 Actress Faces are just, for the most part, a list of women that are often regarded as being beautiful, and I have no idea why. Sarah Jessica Parker looks like a horse. That's just the way it is. I don't understand where this whole gorgeous movie star thing came from, because she looks like a horse. So, my number 5, there are going to be a lot of people that will disagree with me here, but mine is Mrs. Brad Pitt, Angelina Jolie. She's terrifying. She's an absolute fembot. No one is supposed to look that flawless. She's got lips like a Black & Decker shop vac, which I know a lot of guys are just going to call DSLs, and I'll let our listeners sort out whatever that means for themselves, but she looks like she uses those lips to suck the heads off of her mates, like some kind of Hollywood version of a praying mantis.
Oh, man. I gotta give you that one. I really do.
Well, believe me, when the robot war starts, the first evil robot soldiers will look exactly like Angelina Jolie. Mark it.
Oh, man.
You heard it here first.
Is that what Salt's about?
It might be. She's probably a robot. That was one of the previews for Sex and the City. Yep, I'm pretty sure she's just a fembot.
Awesome. All right, well, I had a little fun with my list. I went a little bit all over the place with how I interpreted this in a couple of different places, so. But I want to start off by saying that this list is dedicated to listeners Tony Matisse and DJ Pullout.
Okay.
As an apology for my bad costume list.
Well, I want you to apologize to me, too.
I got a lot of crap for that list. I understand why, right? So I'm hoping to garner some forgiveness by bringing my A-game this time for this list.
What's your number 5?
Number 5 is a woman who I feel is actually a pretty girl, and it's sad the way she's treated. So I go with Michelle Rodriguez.
Okay.
She's been in SWAT and one of the Fast and the Furious movies, which I did not see, and she was in Resident Evil. And she really is a pretty girl. If you see her on the red carpet at these premieres, she's beautiful. So she's always in these movies where they pull her hair back in a braid, they hide her boobs behind a flak jacket, put a gun in her hand, and have her snarl with this sort of constipated look. And I'm done seeing Michelle Rodriguez punch dudes and shoot zombies. I'm done. She's a pretty girl. Let her actually be the pretty girl in a movie for once.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm not saying that every pretty girl has to play pretty and that there's no room for female action stars. That's not the case. The problem is she's never given a good female action star role. She never plays a tough woman who you don't mess with. She just always plays that woman who's kind of damaged, and that's why she's so aggressive.
Yeah, very dude-like parts. And that's the thing is, especially in something like Resident Evil, where she's standing alongside Mila Jovovich, who's badass and looks amazing.
Right.
And then Michelle Rodriguez is almost the polar opposite of that. She might as well be one of the dudes. And it's like, that's not cool.
Yeah, let her let her hair down and unleash her acting skills for a change and give her the opportunity to play some more interesting characters instead of this cut-and-paste female cop role.
Yep.
Give her the chance to really flex her acting muscles and play that Erin Brockovich kind of character for a change.
Absolutely.
That's a good pick.
Thank you.
Well, my number four, again, I'm going to get a lot of people who think I'm crazy, but my number four is Eva Mendes. This is a Hollywood beauty like Sarah Jessica Horseface that I just don't understand. It's not that she isn't my type. It's that she, too, is kind of horse-facey. She's got a set of teeth like the bleacher seats at Fenway Park. You could till soil with those things. She's got that beauty mark, but I'm pretty sure that's just the screw that keeps her giant nose attached to her head. She looks like she's trying to come in first place at a B. Arthur beauty pageant. If you're feeling brave, watch Ghost Rider and see what I'm talking about. But she always gets labeled as this bombshell, and I just don't see it. She's actually a pretty decent actress. I saw Eva Mendes recently in Bad Lieutenant, Port of Call, New Orleans, a ridiculously long title, from a film made by Werner Herzog that has Nicolas Cage in it. It's a freak ride of a movie. She's actually pretty good in it. She's got some skill. I don't know why she's known as being one of these gorgeous bombshell types. She's a good actress, not so much to look at, in my opinion.
My number four is someone that I think everybody kind of knew was going to make the list for one of us, so I went there, and I picked it from a particular movie for a reason. So I went with Renee Zellweger in Empire Records. Everyone knew I was going to have Squishy Face on my list, because she's got a squishy face. And I've seen a bunch of stuff with her in it, and I really like a lot of the stuff she's been in, including Empire Records. The problem is that she's squishy-faced, and then they put her alongside Liv Tyler in this movie.
Right.
Nothing will make you look worse than standing next to Liv Tyler. It's not fair for any actress.
No, it's not. And actually, the character that she played in Empire Records was supposed to be the slutty character, I guess, yep, for lack of a better term. So she was really squishy-faced the whole time, because she's always trying to make eyes at everybody and be this little sexpot character while she's playing opposite the sweet, innocent Liv Tyler character. I thought the role was really fun. I think she's a great actress, and I love Empire Records.
I do too.
But you're right. Yeah, it is tough to be squishy-faced and then have to sit next to Liv Tyler for an hour and a half.
Yeah.
Well, my number three, easy, Scarlett Johansson. Don't get it, never will. She looks like Stephen Fry in a blonde wig and gargling marbles. I absolutely don't get it. She can't act. She always looks like she just finished a 5-round title fight with Chuck Liddell. And she's got this constant expression like she just forgot how to read. Just forgot, right now, in that second. She totally forgot how to read. She's overrated in every possible way.
You're going to get some crap for this list.
I don't care. I don't care. Right now, that's right. It's Angelina Jolie, Eva Mendes, Scarlett Johansson. I don't understand a single one of them.
All right. I can go there with you. My number three, it was kind of the point with the ugly on this one, with the bad face. But I had to mention this particular actress, especially this particular movie, just because basically I wanted to bring them up. Amy Sedaris as Jerry Blank in Strangers with Candy.
That's a fun pick because, man, Amy Sedaris is beautiful.
She's really, really... I would describe her as cute.
Okay, fair enough.
Or adorable. I think those are good words for her. She's got that great, just sort of fun personality. And just she's a really, really pretty girl.
She's very funny.
She's hilarious. I love Amy Sedaris. I love Strangers with Candy. I love the Jerry Blank character. And the whole point was for her to look completely ridiculous.
Yeah, long before it was happening on Ugly Betty, Amy Sedaris has been taking an attractive woman and making her ugly. And it's hilarious. The character is a riot.
Yeah.
Amy Sedaris just transforms into this other person. That's a great pick. That is a really solid pick.
And anytime you can work Amy Sedaris or Strangers with Candy into a list, you have to, just because anyone who's listening who has not seen the show or the movie, go now, right the second. Pause, go watch it. You will not be disappointed by that.
Well, John, my number two, this is the face that ruined The Shining. I'm, of course, talking about Shelley Duvall. She somehow manages to combine Eva Mendes's grill with big doe eyes that look like the giant broken Zenith television in my grandma's living room. Just a dull screen with nothing behind them.
Oh, man.
You remember in Pinocchio when he goes to Pleasure Island and then shit goes south and everyone starts turning into donkeys? Well, Shelley Duvall looks like she's stuck permanently somewhere in that scene. That's my number two.
Nice, I like it. My number two is another transformation type of thing. It's Charlize Theron in Monster.
That was unbelievable.
She is stunningly beautiful. She is gorgeous.
She's the kind of gorgeous that when one of her movies comes on, I feel embarrassed to be watching it.
Yeah.
Like, I am such a hideous chud that I shouldn't even be in the film presence of a woman this striking.
She's beautiful. She put on 30 pounds, and the makeup people did an unbelievable job turning her into Aileen for this movie.
Yeah, Eileen Wuornos, right? The serial killer.
Yep, Eileen Wuornos. Serial killer, female serial killer. She won an Oscar for this. She won a Screen Actors Guild Award for this. Roger Ebert, god of film critics, said, "What Charlize Theron achieves in Patty Jenkins' Monster isn't a performance, but an embodiment." Because it's not just the makeup and the fact she put on 30 pounds. Her acting in this, she becomes this person.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. You know, it's often called a gimmick when an actor loses a bunch of weight or puts on a bunch of weight or changes their appearance to play a role. It's become kind of a punchline in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Well, Charlize Theron knocked it out of the park. It was not a gimmick. It really was a transformation of character. That's a good pick. You definitely went in a more thoughtful approach than I did for this list. Which brings me to my number one, Sandra Bernhard. She's done a lot of television, most notably Roseanne in the 90s. She's done a bunch of small supporting roles, and thank goodness for that. She has a face like a canvas sack full of Idaho potatoes. She looks like Jaws, the guy with the metal teeth from The Spy Who Loved Me that was trying to kill James Bond. So, I mean, if that doesn't help, try this. She looks like a female Joe Pesci. Except she can't act.
Oh, God. Well, my number one. And I know you're thinking, what could possibly beat out Monster, right? I went through this person's filmography to come up with a movie I had seen them in to make sure I could, you know, legitimately put them on my list, because we usually say you've had to have seen the movie to make a bottom five. Fortunately, I had seen one. I would have went and watched one just to put her on my list.
Oh, my.
We share a number one, Sandra Bernhard. And I got her from Hudson Hawk, which I had to bring up that movie because I love it.
Yep. It's true.
She was so pistol-whipped by the ugly stick that she has to be in my number one spot.
Yes.
She's hideous. She's hideous.
Yep. I think it's made worse by the fact that she can't act. That's really what does it for me.
Yeah.
She can't act, and she's got a face like a sack of potatoes.
And she's just got this awful voice, too. Ugh. It's like Fran Drescher, but beat up.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like Fran Drescher on hormone pills.
They charged you 30? I hope I'm getting a piece of the door for this motherfucker. Because you motherfuckers better start laughing, or I want all the money. Shit.
You know, I think it's only fair to let our viewers know right now. I know this is a podcast. It is true that I have a face made for radio. There is a reason that this is not a video podcast. I know we spent a few minutes knocking these poor girls and their weird faces. I am a hideous chud of a human being, and I feel like it's only fair of me to cop to that as we close out this segment.
Absolutely. We both have faces for radio, that's for sure.
Yeah, you have a face for a radio that's turned off and broken.
Thanks.
No problem. Well, I think then that's the perfect time to have a word from our sponsor.
Mrs. P's Patented Pork Puller. When you need to stretch out your sow, turn to Mrs. P's Patented Pork Puller. Keeps your pork lean and tender and makes applying your pork sauce a snap. Mrs. P's Patented Pork Puller. Now available at Sears.
All right, that brings us to our favorite time of the day. Matinee Deathmatch.
I thought you were going to say lunchtime.
This is the game that Mike and I play based on a popular party game in which we pick a category and go back and forth, coming up with movies that fit into that category until one of us, usually me, taps out. You ready for this?
I am ready, John. Are you ready?
Let's do it.
Okay, here we go. Give the titles of different war movies.
Saving Private Ryan.
Apocalypse Now.
Letters to Iwo Jima.
Das Boot.
Flags of Our Father.
Schindler's List.
The Great Escape.
Red Dawn.
Glory.
Platoon.
The Patriot.
Gone with the Wind.
Defiance.
The Bridge on the River Kwai.
A Bridge Too Far.
Inglourious Bastards.
Heartbreak Ridge.
The African Queen.
Casablanca.
Patton.
Full Metal Jacket.
The Deer Hunter.
Pearl Harbor.
Hotel Rwanda.
The Green Zone.
Stalag 17.
Jarhead.
The Hurt Locker.
Siriano.
The Pianist.
Body of Lies.
The Great Dictator.
I think I just tapped myself out again.
All right.
Oh, man.
Well, that was a pretty good run we had going there for a minute, John. There are a lot of war movies. There's a lot of war to choose from.
There's a lot of war.
Well, bad for the world, good for film jitsu. Which is really sort of the opposite of the way it is.
Yeah. What is it good for? Absolutely nothing. Say it again, y'all.
Well, John, then we're getting into that time in the show where we give our staff picks. We've spent a lot of time talking about a terrible Sex and the City movie and some pretty bad actress faces. Before we get into this, I would like to say that I saved my ticket stub from Sex and the City 2. It is now a talisman of hate. If anybody would like a Film Jitsu souvenir, send us an email at mikeandjohn@filmjitsu.com and I will send you my ticket stub from Sex and the City 2 that you can put under the pillow of your worst enemy to wish hatred upon their household. So just put that out there. Drop us a line and we'll see what we can do about that. Well then, JC, why don't you go ahead and give our listeners your staff pick for this week?
All right. I went in a very different direction than Sex and the City 2 in order to give our audience a bit of a palate cleanser. If you were unfortunate enough to take that movie in, try this one on for size. It's a movie with a dynamic cast, Very Bad Things.
It's a great movie.
Great movie. You got Christian Slater, Daniel Stern. Who doesn't love Daniel Stern?
He came up last week on our discussion of Chud.
He did indeed. Cameron Diaz, Jon Favreau, Jeremy Piven. So basically what's going on is Cameron Diaz's character is marrying Jon Favreau's character. But she's got this bridezilla thing going on, very stereotypical bridezilla, like you would not believe. So he is very excited about his trip to Vegas for his bachelor party with all of his buddies. They go to Sin City, they party, things get out of hand, and a major crime is committed. I won't give anything away here, but a major crime is committed. They come back from the trip, and that's where it really kicks into dark comedy overdrive. Everything starts to unravel. The more they try to get a hold of things and keep it together, the more it falls apart. Cameron Diaz starts realizing everything's falling apart. Her character flips out, and it just unravels into craziness from there on out. It is one of the funniest things I've ever seen. Very dark comedy, but quite hilarious. It will have you cracking up laughing and freaking out at the same time. I cannot love this movie more. And in fact, I thought it might even make a good double feature with The Hangover, which we've definitely done as a staff pick before.
It definitely would. That would be a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Maybe throw in a little bit of Swingers there to go with.
Excellent, excellent choices.
If you haven't seen Very Bad Things, then it's definitely a comedy that you should add to your Netflix queue sooner rather than later.
For sure.
Well, my staff pick this week is a film from 2002 starring a young Emile Hirsch and Jenna Malone, and also Jodie Foster in a very rare role. I'm talking about The Dangerous Lives of Altar Boys.
Oh.
It's directed by a guy named Peter Kerr, who basically has done nothing but music videos for the likes of Depeche Mode and REM and Bruce Springsteen. This is the only feature he's done, as best I can tell. He's done some TV work as well. But basically, it's about a group of young men growing up, going to Catholic school, and they're trying to find their way in the world, rebel against Sister Assumpta, played marvelously by Jodie Foster. Jodie Foster plays the evil nun character, who, you know, maybe she's not evil, maybe she is just trying to teach these boys a lesson, but it's a coming-of-age movie. It's got some really neat animation in the film where the boys are trying to basically draw their comic book, and they use Sister Assumpta as the villain in a lot of different ways. The movie takes a turn for the serious that you probably don't see coming. So it goes from sort of a lighthearted, rebellious coming-of-age flick to now we're getting into some serious drama here. It's very good. Not a lot of people saw it. The reviews for it were kind of so-so, but I enjoyed the heck out of it. I mean, anytime you get to see Jodie Foster play mean, you should jump on board. So that is my staff pick. It was written by a guy named Jeff Stockwell. He did the screenplay, and he really hasn't done anything else. He did the screenplay for The Bridge to Terabithia.
Oh, interesting.
Which I never saw. And it was based on a book by Chris Furman. It was a film that flew under a lot of radars, didn't really get anybody famous. Emil Hirsch is doing okay for himself right now, but I don't think it is attributed to the success of this film. But it was just something that I happened to pick up one day and really enjoyed. So if you're looking for, you know, a group of boys sticking it to the Catholic Church, then not only is that timely, given our headlines, but it's also a lot of fun to check out. So The Dangerous Lives of Altar Boys.
All right, Mike, why don't we take some time to read the emails we've been getting in from the listeners. Our faithful listeners are nice enough to email in and share their opinions with us, since we definitely share our opinions with the internets. So what do we got this week?
This week, we received an email from Dan Huffman from the Bob and Dan cast, actually, a Film Jitsu favorite. Dan said, "Hey guys, I've listened to 5 Film Jitsu episodes in the last 2 days. Keep it up. I like what I hear. Let me thank you for taking on Pink Flamingos. I've always heard about this movie. I was a film school guy. And it was only a matter of time before my curiosity won out over my trepidation. Having listened to your episode in which you detail the depravity within, I can now safely say that I will never watch Pink Flamingos. Even better, my cohort Bob was foolish enough to watch it. He is scarred for life." Dan goes on to give us his bottom 5 movie mutants in no particular order. Rogue from X-Men. Not only was she needy and annoying, but she was an unholy amalgam of more than one comic book character. This includes Jubilee, who, as we all know, is the worst X-Man. Number 2, that lumpy mutant guy from 300. He was gross.
Agreed.
He was. What was that about? I didn't understand why there were mutants all of a sudden in that movie.
Well, I think the whole point was supposed to be that they usually killed the babies if they were even slightly deformed. So there was that whole backstory about his father, you know, not killing him, but he was still outcast and all that garbage.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was remembering. Remember there was that big fat guy with the lobster claws, though?
Yeah, that was weird.
Yeah, I don't know. That was gross. He says, Tetsuo from Akira. "I'm Tetsuo. I'm sad because nobody thinks I'm cool. Guess I better destroy Neo Tokyo. What a dick." Piranhas from Piranha. He says he believes they were mutated. "It's been a while since I've seen it. Angry fish are scary." And he closes with the Michael Keaton clones in Multiplicity. "What's worse than Michael Keaton? More than one. Each clone mutated in a different way, proving once and for all that there is no such thing as a good Michael Keaton. Also, who decided that Andie MacDowell was the it girl of the 90s? She was terrible in everything but Groundhog Day." You know I'm going to have to disagree with Dan on that one.
Yeah.
I am squarely pro-Michael Keaton.
I'm a fan of Michael Keaton. Mr. Mom.
Mr. Mom. Or Gung Ho. Have you ever seen Gung Ho?
No.
Check out Gung Ho. It's Michael Keaton and Japanese corporations. It's awesome. So, of course, Dan says, "Take it easy, your podcasting sister, Dan."
Nice. We also have an email from Ryan Colby. Hopefully we're pronouncing that correctly.
We're pronouncing the L this week.
Yes, we are.
Not Colby. We are on the verge of a Lakers-Celtics showdown for the title, and us being New England guys, we're not going to say Kobe this week. So that is distinctly Ryan Colby as far as we're concerned.
Exactly. But he goes by Palooka, so we can go with that.
Okay, yeah, Palooka, that works for me.
There you go. And he writes in on our bullshit movie science moments that we had a couple episodes ago, and he says, "Midichlorians, midi-effin-chlorians, no one, ever asked for a scientific explanation of the Force or how a Jedi got his powers. Keep up the excellent work, guys. Ryan." That is true. Midi fucking chlorian. Seriously.
That was the point. That was the head slap for me.
Yep.
Sitting through the movie, that was the point where I slapped my forehead and said, what the hell is going on here? That was as far over the line as I was willing to accept from the Star Wars franchise.
Absolutely.
We also got an email this week from Mara Thomas, who wanted to suggest a staff pick, actually. She suggested the 1988 Robert De Niro and Charles Grodin flick Midnight Run, directed by Martin Brest, who, aside from having a very funny name, also directed Beverly Hills Cop and Scent of a Woman. Mara says, growing up, I had this on a taped-off HBO VHS tape with Die Hard.
Nice.
Needless to say, I watched both movies incessantly. I went so far as to make a handwritten spreadsheet to tally all the swears. My parents were so proud. Upon rewatching this last week, I'm happy to say it holds up and it's still really funny. It's basically the Bail Bonds version of Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, a great 80s action comedy. Your pal, Alonzo Mosley. I don't know why Mara's Alonzo Mosley this week, but I'm comfortable with it.
Yeah, we'll let her have that.
I actually just added that to my Netflix queue. I haven't seen that in years.
Yeah, that's an oldie but a goodie right there. We got an email in from Chris Parcella, who says, hello again, my friends. I've been out of the loop for a few weeks, so I'm catching up my comments. He says, to you, Mike, I'm with you there. There is nothing bad about Hook. It's my favorite Robin Williams movie. So I'm still getting shit about Hook.
You deserve shit about Hook.
Fine. He says, worst kings, one we didn't mention, Dennis Hopper as King Koopa in the abortion that was Super Mario Brothers the movie.
Oh my.
Which did come up during video games, the bottom five above video games. So, and then he gives us, for worst mutants, the entire cast of Freaked, including Alex Bill S. Preston Esquire Winter, who plays a half-man, half-mutant. And he actually co-directs Freaked.
Oh.
A little bit of trivia for you there. Bit actress Megan Ward and Blossom's older brother Michael Stoyanov, the half-man, half-woman. Mr. T as a bearded lady, which is probably the funniest sentence I've read in a long time. Bobcat Goldthwait as Sockhead, a mutant sock. That turns out it's just a hand that can talk in disguise. And Keanu Reeves, yes, Bill and Ted reunite, as Ortiz the dog boy. There are a lot more awful mutants in it. I suggest you check out the awfulness that is the movie. And oh, the ringleader of Freaked is Randy Quaid, or as he calls him, Randy Uncle Eddie. I drove a plane into a laser, fat ass ranch hand in Brokeback Mountain, and I was Amish in a Bill Murray movie. Quaid.
Yeah, that's the guy.
Yeah, that's him.
Zoinks. We also got an email this week from Alicia Naples, who says, hello, my dearest film jitsus. I'm finally catching up on my film jitsu, and here are a few comments from episodes 3 and 4. Episode 3, what John has forgotten is exactly why his friends wanted to go see Wing Commander. This, of course, was in our bottom 5 video game segment.
Yes.
She says, it was the first movie that had the trailer for Star Wars Episode 1. I remember well that my boyfriend at the time went to the midnight showing of Wing Commander and then walked out after the previews. That must have been it.
Yeah, that probably was. I couldn't remember why anybody would want to see Wing Commander, but that's probably what it was.
I hope it was, because otherwise you just saw Wing Commander on purpose. She also says, John, dude, it's, in the name of the king, a dungeon siege tale. Yeah, it's fucking awful, but mercifully dragon free. That, of course, referring to the terrible Uwe Boll movie that you must have called the Dragon Siege tale.
I think I called it Dragon Siege a number of times. You know what? Fuck that movie and fuck its title.
Yep, there you go. In relation to our Double Team episode, Alicia says, if you guys haven't seen JCVD, you probably should. I actually liked it so much, I said, maybe I should watch more Van Damme movies, to which my boyfriend said, no, you shouldn't. But we both agreed that JCVD was badass. Which it is. I have watched it. JCVD, of course, refers to Jean-Claude Van Damme. And it's a movie where he plays himself, confused with the characters that he plays in his movies. Kind of an My Name is Bruce concept.
Cool.
She goes on to say, I was actually going to suggest bottom 5 vampire movies, but you two beat me to it. I haven't listened yet, but if Dracula 3000 and Twilight aren't on the lists, it is an epic fail. I think they were.
Twilight was your number one.
You're damn right it was.
But neither of us mentioned... I haven't seen Dracula 3000. It sounds like a piece of shit.
Oh, did we mention Dracula 2000?
I did, yes.
Ah, so this was 1,000 more Draculas. Okay, well, I feel pretty good not having seen it. Well, thanks to Alicia for her email.
And she actually came back again, sent in two emails this week. The second one, she had to say that a movie that popped into her head right away while listening to some of the episodes was Private Resort with Johnny Depp.
I haven't seen it.
Neither have I. I actually haven't seen it either. It sounds awful, and I looked it up, and the movie poster is pretty shitty, too. It's just like this row of chicks in bikinis, and then him and his co-star are kind of laying in between them, and the bikinis spell out Private. It's really shitty. She says he's definitely not good, but he's not bad either. But the movie is, oh my god, horrible. And it's on Netflix. Watch instantly. Still not going to watch it.
Nope. Moving on, John. Why don't you give us our last email?
Last email is from our new buddy, Tony Matisse, who I dedicated the bottom five to this week. Hopefully I've earned some respect back from Tony. And he says, when you announced Best Worst Mutant, I had a sudden flash of the guy from RoboCop who gets toxic waste dumped all over him and suddenly gets hit by a car and explodes like a spaghetti bomb. Don't know why. That's one of the best scenes in movie history, I'm not gonna lie.
Yeah, it kinda is.
I remember seeing that as a kid and being really tripped out, but in love with it at the same time.
A spaghetti bomb, I think, is an absolutely flawless description.
And then he says, John, don't feel bad. Break into Electric Boogaloo would stump anyone.
I've seen the movie. I'm still stumped.
Well, that does it for listener feedback. If you want to send in an opinion, give us a staff pick, a bottom five, let us know why we're horribly wrong about something, definitely email us at mikeandjohn@filmjitsu.com. I've waited so long, baby, now that we're friends. The man's got his patience, and here's where mine ends. I want your sex. All right, Mike, it's that time to let you know what you'll be watching next as punishment for Toxic Avenger, since Sex and the City was punishment from our listeners. So, we also have a holiday coming up, this episode that will come out right after Father's Day. So I thought, why don't we think in the realm of a Father's Day kind of movie? And I looked through, and I didn't really like too many of my options, but I found one that's kind of Father's Day, and I just really want to torment you with it.
Oh, well, that works perfectly, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. So I came up with a Robin Williams movie.
A Robin Williams movie about fathers?
Kind of.
Okay. I have a couple ideas already.
Well.
But one of them's sort of awesome, so I don't think that can be it.
Nope. This is from 1995, Jumanji.
Jumanji. Okay, 1995. Jumanji. This is the one about the board game and the jungles and stuff?
Exactly, exactly. Robin Williams playing board games that make jungles come to life.
Okay.
Something I realized while looking into this movie, Kirsten Dunst is in this movie, which I totally blanked on.
You know, I also came to the table armed with some Jumanji factoids, it turns out. You should know that Jumanji was actually filmed right in the beautiful Granite Planet in Keene, New Hampshire.
Yep, it was actually based in Bradford, New Hampshire, was what they claim in the movie.
Oh, well, there you go. Yeah, it was. I remember being a kid, they were shooting the movie, it was a big deal.
Yep.
So how is this a Father's Day movie?
Well, there's this whole theme about him and his father, and his father's kind of neglectful and in his business, so that kind of sets up a lot of the movie, is that, you know, this sort of this longing for his dad and all of that, so...
So it's a daddy issues movie.
It's kind of a daddy issues movie, yes, so...
I guess that's better. I mean, we could have gone with the stepdad, the remake.
Ugh.
Or stepfather, I guess it is.
Yeah, awful.
With not Terry Quinn. Yeah, no, this is good. I mean, not for me, though.
Yeah, well, not for you. But I think the listeners will enjoy listening us talk about Jumanji. And so for a bottom five, I thought since this is kind of the father makes some bad decisions that leads to the son making some bad decisions, which leads to all of the craziness that happens in this movie. So I thought, why don't we go with bottom five parental decisions?
Oh, so bad parental decisions.
Bad parental decisions, yes.
Okay. All right, just...
Parents in movies doing things that really are not good for parents to be doing.
So not necessarily bad dads, just bad decisions.
Yes, bad decisions.
Okay. I think I can make that work, no problem.
Awesome.
Okay, then. That will close out this week's episode of Film Jitsu. Thank you for joining us. Hopefully, you will come back and subject yourself to my review of Jumanji, which I will apparently be reviewing. So, as always, we are your hosts. I am Mike.
And I am John.
We'll see you next time.
Stop. Stalno mislim na te, hoću znat sve kate. Vježbat ću sate i sate. Karate, karate. Vježbat ću dok zadnji mi kjaj zastane.
I take that back and I give you a Skype hug right now.
Thank you.